Blog Talk Radio. The information and opinions expressed by our guests are not necessarily endorsed by this radio show, nor the radio show hosts. The intent of this radio program is to provide information. We encourage the listener to do their own research and connect their own dots. Hi, this is Ari Koppel and Serena on Shattering the Matrix. We have our very distinguished guest tonight, John Lash, who happens to be back with us, and we're going to be discussing a little bit in more detail things that we left off last time, and we're going to also be going into how all the things that are happening on this planet right now, you know, maybe through the Gnostic perspective of what is going on. So, John, you're with us tonight, I'm assuming, here.
Yes, I can hear you.
All right, perfect. Okay, so, John, what I'd love for you to do tonight, if possible, is to start, again, back, you know, with the backstory from the Gnostic teachings about the Sophionic message and, you know, making it more, you know, pertinent to today's events and what's going on today. So if you can give us that backstory again for all our new listeners, that would be fantastic.
Sure, I'll be happy to give it my best shot.
Okay? All right.
I like the term the Sophionic message. It raises a question in the mind. Oh, the Sophionic message. What is that? You know, what is the Sophionic message?
Right.
And of course, once you begin to investigate that a little, the first two things that come to mind, the first two things that become clear are that the Sophionic message comes from a particular group of people who lived in the ancient past who were known as Gnostics and who were the founders and teachers in the so-called mystery schools of the pagan or pre-Christian world. So that's the first thing to establish, where the Sophionic message comes from. It comes from an ancient tradition of spirituality and learning in the past, and the location of the people who originated that message is in the Mediterranean basin of Europe, and particularly to the eastern side of that basin, that is to say in the area of the Levant, which is now Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, and so forth, and including Palestine. The second aspect that needs to be elucidated with that phrase is Sophionic. Well, what does that word mean? It means referring to Sophia. I pronounce the word Sophia to distinguish it from the common use of the name Sophia, which is very commonly found as a girl's name. Did you know, by the way, that the name Sophia is currently the most popular name for a child, female child, in the United States?
I did not know. How about that?
Yeah. Kind of odd.
Very interesting. Yeah, it is a beautiful name.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I modify it slightly to Sophia to distinguish that it is the name of a goddess. And this goddess is the central figure of the mythology of the Gnostics. So the Sophionic message and its relevance today can only be understood in the framework of the story that the Gnostics told about Sophia, about this goddess.
Mm-hmm.
You can call it a star myth if you want. It's a sacred story about the events that occurred in the life of the goddess Sophia. And that is actually the story that establishes the background today. If you want to look at the world today in the perspective of Gnosticism, you have to know what the story is, because the story frames the events of our time. And the basic, it's a story that I've told in 9 episodes in my book, Not in His Image.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a story that you can find on metahistory.org under the title, The Myth of the Fallen Goddess. Or the Fall of the Wisdom Goddess, excuse me. Fall of the Wisdom Goddess.
Okay.
Sophia is also called the Wisdom Goddess because her name, Sophia, means wisdom, as you probably know.
Right.
So what is this story, and why is it so important, and how can it tell us about anything that's happening in the world today? Or more correctly, how could it help us evaluate what's happening in the world today? The story is really unique. The Sophia vision story, as I call it, is really unique because it's the only myth that has been produced by human imagination that actually explains the biography of our planet. And in a way, that's one way to describe this myth, that it is, in fact, the biography of our planet. So it explains the creation of the planet Earth. And along with that, it explains the creation of the human species and a number of other key factors in the story of life on Earth, including the factor of what has been called the alien or ET intrusion upon the human species. So it's a vast story. It's a vast cosmological myth. And the essential thing to know about this myth as we proceed with our conversation today is that it was an open-ended myth. In the way that this story of Sophia was told by the Gnostics, it didn't have a beginning, middle, and end, like all other myths do. It had the last chapters unwritten. And so, in their telling and teaching of the Sophianic myth about the origin of the Earth and the human species, these illumined teachers of the past made a point of saying that the myth is ongoing. The end of the myth is not written. We who are living on the Earth right now, who call ourselves the human species, are part of the conclusion of the myth. We can actually influence how the myth continues from this point on. And that's a very remarkable fact, which you won't find if you go into the vast body of mythology in the world and study the myths that come from various cultures. As you know, like I call myself a comparative mythologist because that is exactly what I've done throughout my life. Mm-hmm. A comparative mythologist is one who looks at the myths of all cultures and races in different times, be it Japanese, Maya, Aztec, Native American, the myths of the Slavic people, of the ancient Greeks, the myths of the ancient Persians, the myths of India. All of these, there's about 150 different genres, really, and compares all these myths. I've done that. Now, you will find in each of these cultures, be it that of the Maya and Aztec or of the Japanese, a creation myth. Each of these ancient cultures had a story to tell in its own way about the origin of humanity, the purpose of human life on Earth, and many other great cosmic matters and mysteries of that kind. The remarkable thing is, if you make an inventory of all these creation myths from around the world, and then you step back, and you look at them all, you will find that there is not one of them that is comparable to the Sophianic narrative of the mysteries. It stands above and beyond all other myths because it presents the only complete and coherent story that we have of the origin of our own species.
Yep.
That's a fact. That's not my opinion. That's not my interpretation. And it's not just a claim I'm making, it's an actual fact. And there's a second fact that goes along with that, and I'd like to bring this to the attention, particularly of those people who might not have heard of this material until now. Those of you who might not be familiar with the Gnostics and the Sophianic vision story, the myth of Sophia, should bear in mind another very significant fact. Of all the paradigms and spiritual teachings in this world that we know of, in recorded history, the message of the Gnostics contained in the Sophiatic myth has been the most repressed and persecuted of all that material.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there has been...
significant.
Are you aware of that?
Yes.
Yeah.
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 Throughout history, there has been an attempt to eradicate this myth that we are going to be using tonight
mm-hmm.
as a lens to look at what is happening in the world these days, what's happening on the planet. I want to just emphasize as we go in that throughout history, there has been a massive campaign to try to prevent the human race from hearing what this myth has to tell us. And you have to ask yourself, well, why would that be?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what is there something in this story that somebody doesn't want you to know? And there is indeed a lot in this story that somebody doesn't want you to know. And so, with that little preface, I would just go into the two or three key elements of the myth that make it relevant to things happening in the world today. Okay?
Go for it. Love to hear it.
All right. All right. The Sophianic vision story, as I call it, says that the human species was designed at the center of this galaxy. So therefore, it tells you where we come from. It says explicitly that in the center of the galaxy that we know is floating in the universe, with the solar system and the planets, including the Earth, circulating in the third arm of that galaxy. It's a four-armed or five-armed spiral galaxy. All of this is astronomy. That is the location of this myth. And according to that myth, although humanity is now living on Earth, which is a planet in a solar system located in the third arm of the galaxy, our species actually originated at the core of the galaxy. That's where we come from. And the story says that in the core of the galaxy there abide the divine beings. There dwell the gods and goddesses of this galaxy. It's only a story about this galaxy we are in. And those gods and goddesses are called aeons in the Gnostic language, A-E-O-N-S. I prefer to translate that word as generators. So these divine beings who inhabit the center of the galaxy are like scientists and artists. They are interested in creating experiments with living life forms. And so they periodically, from within their headquarters, dream up or design life forms. And they actually designed the human genome. They actually designed the DNA structure that results in the propagation of the human species. And that structure is called, in the Gnostic myth, the anthropos, from the Greek word anthropos, meaning human. It was in particular two of these gods and goddesses, one male and one female, at the center of the galaxy who designed us. And then what they did, and this is what the aeons typically do, we are told in the myth, is that they projected this genome, which actually consists of a plasmic substance. You know, DNA is nucleic acid, right?
Right.
Coded nucleic acid.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does that tell you? It tells you two things. First of all, that the substance of humanity, that which causes us to appear on this planet, is not some immaterial, mysterious immaterial spirit.
Mm-hmm.
It is an actual plasm. A living life plasm, and it consists primarily of nucleic acid. But the nucleic acid has been coded in a complex way, as we know now, because the components of the genome have been cataloged, right?
Right.
But who designed the genome? Who were the geniuses and scientists and artists that cooked up that structure? According to the Sophianic myth, it was two aeons from the galactic core named Sophia, who was a female aeon, and Thelete, T-H-E-L-E-T-E, Thelete, who was a male aeon. And they did not produce the genome by any kind of biological type of conjugation. They're not strictly our parents, you know. The biological analogy doesn't work.
Right.
As I said, they're more like scientists or artists. So then the aeons, once some of the aeons working in the galactic headquarters come up with a new life form, and they do this over and over again because that's how they entertain themselves. Once they do that, the entirety of the aeons get involved in watching how the experiments that could unfold with that life form happen. And the way they do that is that they inject the life form externally into the galactic limbs. And that allows it to develop into a kind of mycelium fiber, a mycelium matrix, like the mycelium of a mushroom.
Mm-hmm.
And from that mycelium matrix, strands go out and emanate across the galactic arms, and occasionally those strands, which are like tendrils, living tendrils, they're carried in plasmic currents, land on some planet, they seed in the planet, and that life form begins to evolve on that planet. The name for this kind of evolution, by the way, has been given recently by modern science. It's been called directed panspermia. It's a scientific theory that was proposed around 1900 by Svend Arrhenius, who was a Danish or Swedish physicist. So it's widely recognized mm-hmm. that the seeds of life are floating in the interstellar space of the galaxy, and that occasionally they land in a habitable environment like the planet Earth,
mm-hmm.
and they grow, and then we have what may be called an experiment, a laboratory experiment on a planet with a life form, and we are such an experiment. So the basic answer, and we're about halfway there in this description, okay?
It's awesome.
The basic answer to the questions, the big questions, of course, so they take some time to answer.
Sure.
The basic answer to the question, well, where does human species come from and what are we doing here on Earth, is simple. We are a genomic life form designed by two divine beings in the galactic center. And that life form was seeded so that it could arise in planetary systems that arise automatically in the realm of the galactic arms. And we are now living on a habitable planet where the human genome found the possibility to seed itself and to evolve into what it is today. So we are, in effect, living in a divine experiment. And we are the main topic of that experiment.
Mm-hmm.
No, or the main subject, excuse me, the main subject.
All of this story comes from the Gnostic text.
All this story comes from the Nag Hammadi texts, which were written in Coptic and found in Egypt in December 1945. And some parts of the myth, which I have restored in 9 episodes, the myth is in a very damaged and fragmentary form, as you find the content of it in the textual materials, okay?
Yeah.
So it had to be restored. I compare that to restoring a damaged mosaic. And some parts of the mosaic have been lost. But most parts are there, and it can be put together from the Nag Hammadi codices and a few other, like I would say, half a dozen other classical sources that refer to this story. So these are the actual sources of the story I'm telling you. I'm not making this story up.
Can I ask a quick question, though? Could you define or clarify the difference, perhaps, between what is a myth versus what would be fantasy or fairy tale or something like that?
Sure. Good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because I am a mythologist,
mm-hmm.
and so I tend to use the word myth perhaps in a different way
mm-hmm.
than conventionally. Unfortunately, the term myth has come to mean today either a lie,
mm-hmm.
like the myth of male superiority, you know?
Right.
That's
a big
a lie. It is a lie.
The Gnostics attack that myth.
Don't get her started with this.
No, we won't get her started with that. Or it means a fabrication or some silly and superstitious tale that was invented by people in the past. You know, like the myth that the moon was, the egg laid by an old mother hen.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Okay. Unfortunately, those two definitions miss the true meaning of myth. A myth is a production of human imagination. It's a narrative or story that describes events that actually happened. So the meaning of the word myth, when I use it, is that it is an actual narrative, a script, that describes events that really happened in the universe. And the myth is the story form of telling those events.
Okay.
So, and when I say sacred myth, which this is a sacred myth we're talking about, by sacred myth, I mean that it is a myth about the origins of things, including human life. It is a myth about the sacred powers that bring forth life. So therefore, it is a myth and story about the gods and goddesses. And the Gnostic teachers were perfectly clear that the gods and goddesses, who are important to our story and who originated and designed us to be in the experiment we're in right now, are these so-called aeons who inhabit the galactic center.
Wow, that's great. Thank you.
So if you haven't heard this story before, if you haven't heard this explanation of human origins, the reason why is because it's been kept from you. And it's only by restoring that story in my book in 2006 that it became once again available to the world. So this story has been out there in the world now for about 7 years.
Hmm.
Before that, it was not possible. We couldn't have had this interview before that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I couldn't have told you this story before 2007.
Hmm.
So, back to the story. What they say in the story is that we are part of an experiment. The human species is being watched by these gods and goddesses in the galactic core, and life on Earth is being observed by them to see how we develop and to see if we can play out and live out the potential that they endowed in us, if we can actually discover and express the beautiful gifts that we have as human beings that were given to us when they encoded the human genome. However, there are some peculiar things happening in our experiment here on this planet which were not actually anticipated by the gods when they set up the experiment. Now, that's kind of a bizarre idea,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
When you think about that. I mean, I don't think there's any other myth or religious paradigm that will tell you that things happen in the cosmos that even the gods themselves can't control or predict.
Right, that there was something unexpected.
Something unexpected and unanticipated happened, and there is room for novelty in this myth. There is room for novelty in this development. Novelty is a really big factor. Freedom and novelty are huge factors in this experiment. So there are principally two things that happened in the course of the development of our experiment. I call it the divine experiment on Earth. Two things that happened that were anomalies, or unexpected events. First thing was that the goddess Sophia, who normally would be indwelling the core of the galaxy and observing the human genome seed itself in different worlds and develop and evolve, got enmeshed in the experiment that she designed. She got enmeshed in the experiment. And this was not something that was anticipated. The reason she got enmeshed in the experiment is that after the human genome had been seeded in the galactic arms, she was fascinated by this creature called the Anthropos. She had a passion and an enthusiasm for it. She felt great empathy for it. And her empathy, remember, she's a goddess. She's a power of immense magnitude and consciousness and life dwelling in the galactic center. So great was her emotion and interest in the human experiment that she fell out of the galactic center. This is the way the myth describes it. She plunged from the galactic center and she shifted into the region of the galactic arms, which are circulating around the core. Now, this is not a normal thing to happen. This is the myth of the fall. This is the theme of the fall of the wisdom goddess. Sophia fell from the galactic center, and as a result of that, even more bizarre things happened. As she was found herself out in the realm of the galactic arms, which is not normally where the gods go, she underwent a massive transformation. And the result, the end result of that, was that she turned into a planet. Her energies consolidated and condensed from the pure star matter at the galactic center into a planet. She turned into a planetary body. But that was a very bizarre and anomalous event. That happened because of her passion for humanity drew her into the realms of the universe where humanity would manifest. Is that clear so far?
Yeah, so a quick question on that. Do you believe that she turned into a planet by choice, or was that part of the anomaly?
No, she didn't turn into it by choice. It was her passion that drew her into it.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't a choice. She didn't say, I'm going to leave the realm where the gods generally dwell, where there are no planets, and there is no life form. No life form can exist and unfold in the galactic center. It can be created there, but it has to unfold in that area of the galaxy where planetary worlds arise and die.
Mm-hmm.
So when she left the realm of the gods, the aeons, and passed over into the area of the galaxy where planets arise and die,
mm-hmm.
she came under the laws of physics of that world. And she herself eventually morphed into a planet. But no, absolutely not. She did not initially have the intention to do that. And so part of the pathos and the beauty of this myth is that it challenges you to use your imagination and your emotion to empathize with her in her situation. Of course, once she morphed into the planet, then she had to live the life of the planet, and she had to live out her fate as a planet, and that is what she's doing. And the planet she turned into is the one we're living on.
Okay.
I have a question, John.
Sure.
This term about the fall, this word is used a lot. How is somebody's passion or being enmeshed in the outcome of the Anthropos or the creation of humanity, how is that equated to a fall? Why is that word used?
That word is used because it's a theme, it's a word in mythology that happens to have become attached to this myth in the syntax of the myth. It does not mean a fall in the connotation of going to Well, what is the connotation of fall that you...
It usually means, I think, falling from grace, perhaps, or...
Right.
But I think this one...
It doesn't mean falling from grace, and it doesn't mean falling from a higher state. It means falling from one expression of divine force into another expression. So I also use the word plunge. I mean, if you can come up with a word that is better than the word fall or more or clearer, let me know what it would be.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Generally speak of the fall of the wisdom goddess because it's a term to help visualize what happened.
Right, because when we hear that word, it has the same kind of connotations that most mythologies have when anyone is talking about a feminine principle that is involved in the creation of humanity. There is usually some fall from grace. That's
right.
Why I'm asking about that word, because it doesn't sit well with me, actually, and I think I will think about another one.
Well, I would like you very much to have another one.
Yeah.
But because if that's the connotation it carries, then it's misleading in this respect. She didn't fall into thin.
Right.
She didn't fall into matter. She did fall into matter in a sense. She morphed into a material body. So what are we going to call it? We'll call it the transformation of the wisdom goddess.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
From
her
energetic state in the galactic core, which is pure living light.
Into a physical one.
Into a physical, material, sensuous planet.
Gotcha.
Into a living planet. And it's because of her morphing in the way she did that this planet is alive. It is alive because it is filled with her life. It is this planet, the planet Earth, is the body and manifestation of a divine being that originally dwelt in the galactic core.
Yeah.
Now,
great explanation.
Okay. Now, something else that may be helpful is the fact that in almost all mythologies around the world and in all folklore and all cultures, almost without exception, there's a recognition that the planet Earth is female. And so we have the term Mother Earth, Mother Nature, and we have the term the goddess in reference to the Earth goddess. And there are countless examples of that around the world, aren't there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we could say that just speaking phenomenologically, the human mind has had a tendency to perceive the planet, the habitat where we live, as a goddess, as a divine feminine presence. That's universal. But the Gnostic story adds something to that. It adds something really momentous. And you have to stop for a moment to get your mind around this. The Gnostic story says, yes, that is true. In fact, you are perceiving the presence of a divine feminine force in the earth. But that divine feminine force had an existence before it turned into the earth. And that is something that most of the indigenous mythologies don't tell us. They don't tell us how this Mother Nature entity, this Mother Goddess, came to be embodied in the earth. They recognize she is there, but they don't say how she came to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see that difference?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, that's why this myth is so unique and so important, is because it explains that she came to be there through her deep and profound fascination and passion for what would happen to humanity as it evolved. And the one thing that she didn't intend, and this is the anomaly, is that she did not intend to be the setting of the experiment that she set up.
The irony.
A great irony.
Yep.
She is now actually the setting of an experiment where humanity is unfolding. all experiments with life forms in this galaxy and other galaxies need a setting, a petri dish,
yep.
a laboratory. And the laboratory for this experiment we're in is obviously the Earth. But the odd thing is that she, who designed us in the first place when she was not the Earth, is now the Earth.
Okay. All right. So that's a great background. Okay.
Yeah, it's great.
That's a great background.
Mm-hmm.
So to come forward and to bring it up to today, you have to know about what is called Sophia's correction.
Mm-hmm.
This Nakamadi material contains a strange concept, which is called the concept of Sophia's correction, and that is the word used. It's from a Greek word, diorthosis, translated as correction. What is Sophia's correction? Well, the Greek and the ancient seers of the mysteries who developed this story as a true description of events in the universe said that things are going to go wrong with the experiment with humanity on the Earth. Things are going to go wrong. The experiment will go wrong because of certain intruding factors, namely the so-called Archons, or the ET aliens, who will attack the experiment. And they said that at a certain critical moment in the future, they left this myth open, at a critical moment in the future, Sophia herself will awaken. The consciousness of the planet itself will awaken, and it will join with human consciousness to correct this experiment we are in, so that it returns to its divine purpose. So they knew that the experiment was going to go off track. They knew that humanity would not be able to realize its divine potential. But they also foresaw the moment when Sophia herself, acting with humanity, or those of the human beings who would recognize her, would correct this experiment. That is called the moment of Sophia's correction. And that moment is now. And so if you would ask a Gnostic what is happening in the world today, like myself being a modern-day Gnostic, I would say, I view everything that's happening in the world in terms of how it relates or does not relate to Sophia's correction.
Makes sense.
The awakening of the wisdom goddess.
Mm-hmm.
The awakening of the wisdom goddess, right?
So how do you see, John, that the correction is happening now? Can you explain that?
I see it in many, many ways, yeah. About 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, in June of 2011, I sent out an email, group email, to about 150 people. At that time, I proposed to them that they follow me in a little experiment we would do together called the Gaian Navigation Experiment. And what I proposed was that we would observe together as a team, as a class, observe things happening in the world, and observe things happening in our own lives, which are also part of this divine experiment. Your life is an aspect of
this. And in our dreams as well.
And in our dreams, in our psychic experiences, in our relationships, in every aspect of our lives, to observe things that might indicate that Sophia's correction is happening and that what the Gnostics predicted is coming true. Although it wasn't a prophecy, because they didn't predict how it would work out. You understand that nuance.
Sure.
They just said it would happen, but they didn't predict what would result from it happening. So, I proposed in the Gaia Navigation Experiment that a group of people, along with me, would gather our observations and share them and see what we could see. And we've been doing this now for about 2 years and 4 months. And we've seen a number of things happening. First of all, there are great Earth changes happening on the planet over the last 2 years. And there are many anomalies that are observed I don't know if you know about the anomalies of the moon, but people are observing that the moon is behaving in a very strange way.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And there are startling YouTube clips about it.
Mm-hmm.
And even some scientists have dared to speak about it, although most of them have ignored it because it blows their paradigm.
Right.
What's happening? What is happening with the moon?
Well, it appears at a different angle than it should be in the sky. The cycle of the moon seems to be rather erratic. The lunar month seems to happen at sometimes some months faster than it happens at other months and slower at other months. And I indicated to the crew, as I call them, the crew of the Gaia navigation experiment, that is the people who are involved in it with me,
mm-hmm.
that we would observe the moon very closely because the moon is part of the Gaian ecosystem. It is actually part of the Earth. It is not an artificial satellite. That notion is a horrible idea and a very bad idea and totally and completely wrong. The moon is part of Gaia Sophia's own dynamics. It's part of the ecosystem. And I said that by observing analogies of the moon, we might notice that two things are happening to the solar system. Now, just bear in mind that the solar system is very big and the Earth is very, very big. And most people don't even realize how big the Earth is. But let's imagine that you're on the Titanic. But you're not just on the Titanic that they built, the one that sank. You're on a boat that's 1,000 times larger than the Titanic, if you can imagine that. You're on an ocean liner that's 1,000 times larger than the Titanic, and you are an ant. Well, do you think that that ant is going to know if the Titanic changes course?
It's probably going to be... Yeah, it won't be, it won't be detected, right?
It's not likely to be detected by the ant
right.
on the deck of the Titanic
yeah.
that the Titanic is changing course. Okay? Nevertheless, it is possible, due to the minds that we have been given by the goddess herself, due to the wonders of human intelligence, it is possible for human beings to know what the mothership is doing. We are on the planet. I call it the mothership in the Gaian navigation experiment. I use a nautical metaphor. And what we are observing is that the mothership, the Earth, is beginning to break away from the solar system.
Huh.
This is one thing that we're observing.
Interesting.
It's beginning to break away from the other planets in the solar system. It's very interesting that over the last 10 years, and even more recently, astronomers have told us that there are such things as free-roving planets in the galactic arms.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Earth is not a free-roving planet. It moves in a solar system along with Venus and Mercury, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. So it moves like as if it were in a fleet of ships, the other ships being the other planets. And they all move in regular patterns in relation to each other. But what we've detected in the Gaian navigation experiment is that the Earth is beginning to free itself to a degree, not entirely, from the capture of the planetary system.
The capture.
It's captured in the planetary system. It's a planetary body captured in the mechanics of the planetary system, but capable of acting like a free-moving planet. And that is indeed what it is beginning to do. And that is probably the greatest sign of Sophia's correction, that she is undertaking her own navigation and her own propulsion. You know, right now, we, as we're having this conversation, you're in one part of the Earth, I'm on another part of the globe. We're separated by about 6 time zones, okay? We are both on the deck of the mother ship, though. It's a very big ship, right?
Right.
And we're moving at 64,000 miles an hour. Right now. That is equivalent to about 18 miles a second.
Mm-hmm.
So as we're having this conversation,
yeah.
If I say something that takes 5 seconds, then the Earth has moved in that time 5 times 18 miles. It's moved about 90 miles in 5 seconds.
Right.
We're moving at 64,000 miles an hour. Science tells us this about the Earth and its orbital velocity. But what we can now detect in the Gnostic perspective is that there would be subtle changes in the velocity of the Earth, and they would cause great upheaval not only upon Earth itself, but throughout the whole planetary system. And this is exactly what science reports these days. All the planets are changing. Jupiter has strange things have been happening on Jupiter. There was an explosion on Jupiter last year in September,
mm-hmm.
which has never been explained, but can be explained in the Gaian navigation experiment. And on the whole, there are anomalies and erratic things happening in the solar system. So I would say that is the first evidence that Sophia's correction is underway. The planet Earth is becoming capable of navigating on its own course and of navigating by its own propulsion, free of the capture of the planetary system.
I say that's good news.
It's great news. It's great because it's a story about the liberation of the planet itself. As the goddess awakens, as the Aeon Sophia takes charge of this experiment for which she is now the setting, fantastic things happen on the cosmic scale.
So John, just let me real quick so I can understand what you're saying. So based on your observation and of your crew members, you're observing that the velocity is changing. Is it speeding? Is it getting slower? And is the Earth changes that we're experiencing now, is that evidence of the fact that there's a change in speed?
Yeah, the Earth changes have to do with the change in speed with her propulsion.
Okay.
Remember, there are two factors here.
Right.
Navigation or steering and propulsion.
Okay.
So suppose that you were driving a car, but the car was rigged in such a way that it automatically drove itself. Therefore, the speed of the car and the direction of the car would be controlled automatically. You would be sitting in the driver's seat, and you might have your feet on the pedals and your hands on the wheel, but there would be some overriding force that would be determining where the car was going. Now imagine that slowly, not suddenly, but slowly, by increments, you began to be able to take control of the steering of the car,
mm-hmm.
as well as to control its acceleration. At first, that would not be a stable activity. And right now, as regards the Earth, she has not stabilized that activity. So one of the things that we observe is that there are erratic changes happening in the way that the Earth behaves, and there are very erratic upheavals in the power of the Earth herself, in her geomagnetic power, her geomagnetic field. All of these things are in flux right now because she is in transition toward a self-navigating, self-propagating condition.
Okay. Makes sense.
So it hasn't stabilized yet, so it's a little bit difficult to say, to pinpoint exactly in a consistent way what the changes are. But one thing is certain, that which will allow her to assume self-propulsion are two things: the electromagnetic field of the Earth and the geo physical power of the planet itself. What do I mean by the geophysical power? I mean the volcanoes, mainly. The volcanoes and the undersea volcanoes, of which there are thousands, and the volcanoes of the Earth are her steam engines, as it were. Those steam engines are becoming very, very active. And so it's very probable, excuse me, that as the Earth becomes self-propelling, there's going to be an enormous rise in the volcanic activity all around the world. Subsequently, and science reports this to be true, there is an enormous change happening, enormous, massive global change happening in the geomagnetic field of the Earth. They're saying that things are happening in the geomagnetic field of the Earth, as you know, that science can't explain.
Mm-hmm.
The field is like breaking down.
Yeah.
Now, there's another inexplicable thing, according to conventional science, that confirms these factors, and that is that we are supposed to be at a high solar maximum
right. In
the sunspot cycle. But paradoxically, oddly, bizarrely, the sun is extremely quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
And this has been observed, especially over the last 2 years, with great, great alarm and puzzlement, as you probably know. There are moments when the sunspot disk is absolutely clear of spots.
Yep.
This is unheard of. This is inexplicable. We are supposed to be at a solar maximum.
Right, that's the pattern, the 11-year pattern, right?
That's right, the 11 and something year pattern, 11 and a half year pattern. How does that relate to Sophia's correction? Well, there's an episode in the myth that says that the sun, which is called the mother star in this myth, it's also feminine, the sun is another celestial body, and it has consciousness, it has a mind, and it can observe. It doesn't have sense organs like we do, but it can observe. You can also observe without your sense organs. That's what you do when you dream.
Sure.
How can you see anything in a dream? You're not using your sense organs. You're asleep.
Hi.
Your eyes are closed. Right?
Yeah.
So if a human animal, a simple human animal, I use the term human animal rather than human being, if a simple human animal can see things without their sense organs, then what do you think a cosmic being can do?
Yep.
So, the sun can see, the sun is conscious, and the story says that the sun, which is a star, recognized the plight of the Aeon Sophia when she turned into the earth. We won't say she fell, we'll say when she morphed into the earth. And the sun, being possessed of a consciousness at the level of a divine being, recognized her plight and decided to assist her. And so that accounts, in Gnostic terms, for the remarkable fact that the sun has an intensity of radiation that could destroy all life on Earth and really ought to do so, but it doesn't. For some reason, the sun assists life on Earth and makes life possible in terms that we know it. And so you can say that the sun today is taking a step backward. It is stepping back and allowing the earth, which is the body of the divine Sophia, to pursue her own course. And this is demonstrated by the bizarrely low level of solar activity and solar emissions. Finally, the changes in the geomagnetic field of the Earth are also part of the evidence of correction as we're tracking it in the Gaian navigation experiment.
So are you referring to the Schumann resonance?
Well, I don't know about the Schumann resonance. Is the Schumann resonance actually changing?
Well, nobody knows. This is a mystery because it's supposed to be 7.83 hertz. But all of those devices and tracking devices that tell you what it is are no longer available. You can't find out what's happening, and the numbers are supposed to be going up, from what I understand. But
that's
I don't know how to
confirm.
Yeah.
That's what I'd heard too. And yet I withheld judgment on that because I didn't know what the sources of were. You know, what are the sources, what recordings can we refer to that would tell us that the Schumann resonance is actually going up?
Yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised if the Schumann resonance was going up and down. I wouldn't be surprised if it was becoming unstable while the Earth is undergoing these changes. One thing is certainly on record, and that is the geomagnetic field of the Earth is incredibly unstable. The North Magnetic Pole is moving very rapidly. And the general structure of the North and South poles of Earth magnetism is disintegrating. And the general magnetic charge of the Earth is reaching what scientists call a zero point, which is to say it's going to a reset.
Hmm. Wow.
So this, again, is astronomical and geophysical evidence that something is happening to the Earth that fits the story of Sophia's correction.
Okay.
But let's see if we can move on now rather to the human drama on Earth,
yeah,
to the human experiment itself,
mm-hmm,
and see if there are events happening in the world at large that might be indicative that Sophia's correction is taking place.
Oh, yes, please, yes.
Yeah, I think that's where, excuse me, that's where we might see some events and changes that are even more pertinent because we ourselves are obviously engaged in them.
Mm-hmm.
First thing that I would point to is what is currently happening in the geopolitical drama, in the geopolitical theater, as I call it.
Right.
Namely, what is happening in Syria. If you look at the world situation today, you find that it has come to a head. The situation has come to a critical point where there is either going to be an endgame scenario or there isn't. And that drama has been acted out in the Middle East, of course, for some time now.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, ever since Israel was created, there has been a big drama going on in the Middle East, as everyone knows. But we're actually reaching the point, amazing to say, when that drama could be resolved. The reason being that just last month, in September, there were game-changing events in that area of the world. The main thing that happened, to put it very simply and to condense it, is that Russia stood up against Israel. Now that's a very, very big event, because Israel is a country that causes a lot of problems in the world, as everyone knows. And it's a country that violates all human rights and all human laws of decency, and yet expects no one to stand up to it. No one challenges it. But it has been challenged. Israel in the world of nations, in the human community of nations, is like a big bully, and a very dangerous bully, because they have nuclear weapons. And finally, another country stood up to the bully, and that was Russia. And Syria is standing up to the bully. And basically, the Russian president made a statement, and he said, if anyone attacks Syria for any reason, we're going to take out Israel. That was done in September of this month, of this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a very big thing. That is a very, very big game changer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how does that relate to Sophia's correction? Well, there are three countries right now in the Middle East. There's two countries in the Middle East and one in alliance to those countries that is changing the game on the global scale. The two countries in the Middle East that are the current focus of a positive breakthrough for humanity are Syria and Iran. Syria is the country where the Zionist plan to take over the entire Middle East and create a greater Israel using the American military as the proxy to achieve that goal has been defeated. The Zionist plan has now been defeated because it depended on taking down Syria, like Libya was taken down, like these other countries were taken down on false premises of bringing democracy to them. That's, as you know, that's not true.
Right.
They're being taken down as part of a massive program of a Zionist greater Israel.
Mm-hmm.
This is a narrative that many people are learning on the internet. Well, that has changed now. That's not happening. And the two countries in the Middle East who are not allowing that to happen and who are opposing it are Syria and Iran. What also happened in September is that the newly elected president of Iran said, hey, we've been telling the truth all along. We don't have nuclear weapons and we don't intend to get any in attack Israel. In fact, we'd like everybody to turn in their nuclear weapons and have peace. I mean, this is an absolutely brilliant move.
Mm-hmm.
Look at how this makes the warmongers look.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So these big geopolitical changes in the Middle East have been supported by one major country, Russia. So I think it would be fair to say that today, the geopolitical situation in this world and the possibility of avoiding a horrific endgame of World War III is due to these three countries. Well, what do these three countries have to do with the Sofianic vision of the mysteries? They have everything in the world to do with it. In the first place, take Iran. The ancient spiritual order, which I call the Magian Order, M-A-G-I-A-N, was a school or community of enlightened shamans and mystics. And that school, the Magian Order, is the root of the Gnostic movement. So what we know about the Gnostics, who bring us the Sophia creation myth, is that they existed at a certain time in the Middle East. But if you go back and you track to the origin of the Gnostic movement, you find that it comes from the Magian Order. And the Magian Order was founded, guess where? In Iran.
Huh.
And so when you look at the entire world and all the countries in the world and ask yourself, where is the root of the Gnostic story of the ancient Sophia, the answer is the root is in Iran. And now it so happens that Iran is going to be a key player in turning the nightmare of the Zionists into, in defeating the nightmare of the Zionists and turning the world geopolitical situation in an entirely new direction. Iran.
Wow.
Now look at Syria. What does Syria have to do with the Gnostics and the Sophianic mysteries? Okay, bear in mind that the ancient taproot of the Gnostic mysteries was the Magian Order, which was founded in Iran, in the northernmost part of Iran, near Lake Urmia, around 6,000 years ago. So that's prehistorical.
Yeah.
So the prehistorical root of the Sophia myth is in Iran, but the historical root of it is in Syria. Because Syria is the heartland of the ancient mysteries. Syria is the place. Syria and Lebanon, and to a certain degree, part of Turkey, because of Antioch, is in Turkey. So Syria, Lebanon, and Turkey as a whole were the countries in pre-Christian times that harbored the mystery schools, and they were what you can call the heartland of the Sophianic vision story that I've been recounting.
Yeah.
You can't say that about Brazil, you can't say it about China, you can't say it about India. It's only that area of the world. So isn't it interesting that we would be looking at the turning point for this planet?
Mm-hmm.
The turning point, turning away from the nightmare of the Zionist Holocaust, because the Zionists are the enemies of humanity, because we're the goy. well, I'll speak for myself, I'm a goy. I'm not Jewish.
Right, right.
And the program of the Zionists is that if you are not Jewish, you are goy, and their agenda is to destroy the goy, to destroy or enslave the goy. You know that. That is a stated fact.
Wow.
In Talmudic Judaism, right?
I didn't know that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Talmudic Judaism states that the mission of the true Jewish people, who can define themselves as Jews, which itself is a fiction and a psyop, nobody knows what a Jew actually is, you know.
Right.
Is it a race? Is it a religion? What is it? But the Talmud expresses an ideology of anti-humanism.
Hmm.
And the Talmud contains an agenda against humanity. And that agenda against humanity is based on an older program, which is the program of the patriarch Abraham.
Right.
Because Abraham is the fatherhead of the master race theory. And what is the master race theory? It's not something that the Germans came up with. Did you know, by the way, that Hitler was accused of following an agenda of the master race theory, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that the German equivalent of the term master race doesn't even exist?
Hmm.
If you were to ask yourself, if you were going to go and do research and said, I'd like to find out, really, what is the documentary basis and what is the historical evidence that Hitler was following an agenda of a master race domination? And you go and look in the German language, and you go and look actually in the speeches of Hitler and in the documents of the Nazi Party for the German words for master race. Guess what?
What?
It doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist.
Hmm.
You won't find it. And the reason for that is because the origin of the master race theory is with the Jews and the Zionists. Not with the Germans, not with the Nazis. And so this problem of Zionism belongs in the Sophianic vision story as well, because there is a chapter or aspect of the story that warns that an alien species intruded upon humanity by infecting a certain part of humanity with a kind of virus, a kind of mental virus. And this mental virus is called master race theory. And so the Abrahamic religion is the expression of this virus.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a virus. And the virus, the source of the virus is extraterrestrial, by the way.
Right.
The archons are the source of this virus. But they did succeed in implanting this virus in a small tribal group of ancient people. And over time, that small tribal group, the ancient Hebrews, came to assume great, great power in the world. Now let's just look at this for a minute, if you don't mind, because I'd like to elucidate something about the power of the Jews in the world today. And I can relate it directly to the Gnostic message, because the Gnostics warned us about this. It's one of the reasons why the Gnostics were attacked and eliminated,
mm-hmm.
is because they came out 2,000 years ago with what I'm going to tell you right now. First of all, they said that the God of the Jews, Jehovah or Yahweh, is actually a demented alien and a very dangerous character.
Yep.
Okay.
It's not the true God, huh?
Okay.
It's an archon.
Right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
The Gnostics came out at the beginning of the Christian era. Until the beginning of the Christian era, they didn't come out in public with this claim, with this expose. The reason they didn't was because they watched the Jews very carefully. They watched Jewish religion since its origin in the time of Abraham. That would be about 1800 BC. And they watched the Jewish religion develop, and they knew, because they were seers with parapsychological powers, to observe the unknown worlds and to observe psychically the alien influences upon humanity. They knew that this alien intrusion had taken place, but up until a certain moment, it was relatively contained. Why? Because it's a known fact that the Jewish religion doesn't evangelize. Correct?
Right.
They don't go around converting. They keep to themselves. It's a closed club, isn't it?
True.
So they saw this infection. It's like the Gnostics saw this infection of the Abrahamic religion. And they knew it came from these archons, who are extraterrestrials, who are mind parasites. They said, well, as long as it remains in this community of people who are closed unto themselves, there's nothing to worry about. But then, of course, guess what happened? With the drama of Saint Paul, the virus of Judaism went into Christianity, and it went into a pandemic explosion.
Yeah.
I describe this in the first five chapters of my book, Not in His Image.
Yeah.
I describe these developments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So as soon as that happened, the Gnostics got very concerned. Yeah, did you have a question?
No. I'm agreeing. I'm following along. Yeah.
Okay. Don't worry. We're going to come back to the Zionists and the Nazis. It's all very relevant.
Okay.
So the Gnostics came out of anonymity because they did not announce themselves. They were very humble. They came out and they said, oh, excuse me, folks. We see that this religion of Judaism with its master race theory, the chosen people, that's master race theory, causes a separation in the human race. It's splitting humanity into two parts, and this is very, very bad. This is a very bad thing, so we're going to come out and warn you about it, and we're going to tell you two things. And they came out and they said, first of all, those whom the Jews hold to be their supreme creator God is actually a demented pretender God, an alien entity called Yaldabaoth, and it's an extraterrestrial. And that entity is actually hostile to the human species. So all those who worship Yahweh are actually hostile to the human species. So watch out for that. It's very dangerous. The Gnostics warned us about it. The second thing they said, and this is where I will bring it up to the Zionists today. They said, we're living in a divine experiment here on the earth. And we can tell you all about the experiment if you want to know. We can tell you how it began, who designed the human genome, how it turns out that one of the designers of the genome is now involved in the experiment with us in a way that was not intentionally determined from the beginning. We can also tell you how that same entity, the Aeon Sophia, accidentally produced this alien species. It's her responsibility that we are faced with an attack from these ET archons. And they said, we can explain all that to you. These are our teachings. We have been cultivating them for thousands of years. But we'd just like to point out to you one very obvious fact. If this experiment with humanity on this planet is going to succeed, it has to succeed as a whole. It has to succeed synergetically. But if you split humanity into a faction who holds themselves separate and superior, defining themselves as the master race and chosen race, and divide them from the rest of humanity, called the Goyim, you will threaten the whole experiment to failure. You can't do that. Let me give you a very simple analogy for that. Take a basketball team. I don't know how many people there are in a basketball team. 9 players? something like that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know anything about sports either, but I'm using a sport analogy because I think it will really get the message across. A basketball team has, say, 9 players, and they each have different positions and roles in the game. If they're going to win the game, they have to work as a team. If there's 1 or 2 people on the basketball team who are playing for the other team, then what are you going to have? The game will fail.
Sure.
You know,
yep.
This is an integral experiment. Humanity is intended to succeed in its divine potential as a single unit. If you split it into 2 parts and alienate them from each other, the experiment cannot succeed. The Gnostics warned us about that 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how I explain the power of the Jews today. It's finally come to the point where the taboos are breaking down about the Jews. And you can say that they have an inordinate influence in the media, that they own the media. You can say that now, can't you?
Oh, sure, in Hollywood as well.
They even admit it. Yep. The Jews run Hollywood, and what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're so what, right?
Yeah.
You can say that they have an inordinate control of the American political system, that the Jews run American foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not run for the good of America. It's freaking destroying America with American foreign policy. Why? Because American foreign policy is run by the neocon Jewish advisors of the president and by AIPAC. This you can say today, finally, the taboo against saying that the Jews have more control than they ought to have in the world, considering what a tiny percentage of the human population they are. Why do they have such massive control over the banking system, over political agendas, over the media, over Hollywood? Why? It's not because they're powerful in themselves, and it's not because they are smarter than everyone else, like they like to think. Why do the Jews, who constitute a minute fraction of the population of humanity, have such enormous influence over humanity? The reason is because they represent the split in the human species where it turns against itself. And this experiment cannot abide that split. That split alone is enough to cause this experiment to fail.
Huh. Wow.
That is why master race theory is so dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And just to get back to Hitler for a minute, to put a fine point on this argument, I would make this historical observation to people listening to this talk. I know we're talking about many difficult things here, and some of the things I'm saying are covered by taboos, and there are going to be immediate knee-jerk reactions to what I'm saying. I ask you to keep an open mind, and I ask you to consider this. This is a fact that I'm telling you right now. Apart from Vladimir Putin, and I'm not making him a hero, by the way, he's a gangster, but he did stand up to the Zionists. Apart from Vladimir Putin, who stood up to the Zionist Israeli faction in September of 2013, there's only one other example I know of in history of someone who stood up to the Zionists. Do you know who that is?
No.
Adolf Hitler stood up to the Zionists. He stood up to what was called the Bolsheviks. Who were the Bolsheviks? The Bolsheviks were the Jewish ideologues who ran the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution was hijacked by international bankers. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
You didn't? Okay.
Mm-mm.
The main people who ran the Russian Revolution, particularly Lenin, were working for the international banking cartel largely run by the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, and other Jewish interests. They financed the 200 or so leading Bolshevik communists. That wasn't the way the Russian Revolution started. The Russian Revolution started as a genuine people's revolution against the tyranny of the Tsarist regime in order to have a more fair and free life in Russia. But as soon as the Russian Revolution began, it was hijacked in that manner. So, Bolshevism and the Bolsheviks are the instrument of the Jewish communist movement. Communism is a Jewish creation. This is a fact. I'm not saying things that are anti-Semitic constructions against the Jews. I'm just stating the facts. Fortunately, I can state the facts now because many people are starting to state the facts. And the taboo against saying anything about the Jews in this manner is breaking down very rapidly. I just want to point out to you that no matter what you think of Adolf Hitler, and I'm not heroicizing Hitler or whitewashing him in any way, I'm not saying anything about whether he was a good man or a bad man, but I'm saying this one fact that ought to be known to every responsible person in this world. The reason why he attacked Russia was to protect Germany and Europe as a whole from Bolshevik communism, which is a program of the Jews take over humanity.
Did he know that?
He absolutely knew it.
Okay.
There was in Bavaria at the time that Hitler was elected to power a movement of Jewish Bolshevism, of Bolshevik communism in Bavaria, and he stamped it out. Because communism, by the way, is a very, very evil ideology. I hope you know that. I mean, I hope the people listening to me know that. Look at the record of mass murder on this planet. Mao Zedong, the Russian Revolution. The number of people murdered by the Jewish Bolsheviks in Russia is probably anywhere from 30,000 up to 70,000, 70 million. According to Alexander Solzhenitsyn, it was 70 million died in the gulags. Communism is a very, very evil, it's a very evil movement that is an expression of Zionism. Communism is an expression of the master race theory.
Mm-hmm.
So the most important thing here is that it's an alien construct that is anti-human, basically.
Basically,
that's the most important thing. And thank you for bringing me back to the point, because we can really get away on this. So the point is that the opposition to this alien construct and the communist Zionist dream that works against humanity has come from Russia. But Russia is also the country where the Sofianic vision has been carried in a very powerful way in the souls and minds of the Russian people. So it's no accident that it comes out of Russia.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So those three countries, Iran, Syria, and Russia, are deeply connected historically with the Sofianic vision of life. That's the point.
Okay. That makes sense. Right,
it's difficult to talk about these matters, but I'm glad we covered that because it is illuminating
mm-hmm.
in regard to many things that are happening in the world today.
Mm-hmm. It's relevant, and it's bringing some of the points from a point of origin up to current events. So that's pretty interesting.
Right.
Yeah, it gives us continuity, you know. And although it is difficult in certain ways, we need continuity. That's another thing that's happened with our species, is that our historical sense of where we come from and the continuity of our experience has been broken, and there is a struggle to regain this continuity. And this is also a sign of Sophia's correction, to remember our true history. as a species.
Absolutely.
It's really, really important right now.
John, can you address the rise of armed resistance and you know, the Gnostics' awareness of the need for defense and that type of thing?
Sure. I think that another positive sign that Sophia's correction is happening is that there is a rise of armed resistance in the world. Armed resistance against what? Well, against the corruption and control of the predatory class of the psychopaths. You know, one of the things that many people have learned, thankfully through the alternative medium of the internet, which we're using right now, since 9/11, is that there is a massive pattern of perpetration on this planet. There's a massive deceit taking place in the financial and political world. So we're facing massive deceit and corruption. And although 9/11 was a horrible and traumatic event, I would say that it is having, in a way, a very positive outcome.
Mm-hmm.
In a short period of time, you know, 12 years is not a long period of time in terms of human generations, is it?
Yeah, I know.
And there's been enormous amount of education and enlightenment during these 12 years. And one of the things that we're seeing now, which again relates to the Gnostic perspective, is that the Gnostics were destroyed in their time because they did not have the ability to defend themselves in an armed way.
Right, yeah.
Right. And so some people today even doubt that the mystery schools existed and that there was a vast network of spiritual education involving these Gnostic teachers who preserved the Sophianic myth and so forth. Some people even doubt it. I've been accused, I think on some occasions, of like making this whole thing up. Because there is so little evidence of it, and the reason why is because the evidence was destroyed. Well, does that remind you of anything? Let's go back to 9/11.
Right.
Was the evidence of that event destroyed?
Amazing.
Let's go back to the Kennedy assassination. By the way, we're coming up to the 50th anniversary of that November. I think it's going to be a tremendous breakthrough event. I look to it very positively. So let's go back and look at the Kennedy assassination. Gee, was the evidence destroyed? Totally. And not only was the evidence destroyed, but about 140 different people who provided that evidence were murdered.
Yeah.
So we're looking at a situation where we're waking up to the fact that we are those of us who would like to carry forward the divine experiment of the Sophia, which simply means nothing more or less than to live together in love and harmony and thrive in the beauty of our divine potential. That's all it means. We are her children, in a sense. She wants us to discover and share our talent and play. But the brutal fact is that we cannot play with each other because some human animals don't want us to play.
Right.
That's the brutal fact of it.
Yeah.
Those are the psychopaths. Those are the predator class. They want to play in their way. And we know what kind of games they play.
Yeah.
They shoot presidents in the pub in broad daylight. They blow up people and make up lies about how it was done, right?
Yeah.
We have to face those people. The Gnostics were among the first to point to the danger of this psychopathic class. And in their time, they didn't have the ability to resist them. They didn't have armed resistance. Today we have it. But even more than armed resistance, and here we go to a really tough point. We're touching some very tough points in this interview. And I don't want to dwell on this point and get stuck in it, but I really must make this point to the listeners. What the Gnostics also lacked that we need to find today that resulted in them being unable to defend their sacred lineage was that they lacked hatred. And there's a big problem with hatred in our world, because hatred has a very bad name, and nobody wants to be known as a hateful person, do they?
Nope.
I don't want to be known as a hateful person, and I'm not a hateful person. But I can tell you that in this experiment, hate plays a role, a positive role. It can play a positive role. And if human beings cannot find in themselves the hatred for those who destroy freedom and who lie and deceive and corrupt this experiment, then we shall not be able to save this experiment. The experiment cannot be saved through love alone. And the problem with the Gnostics is that they did not have enough hate, because they were beautiful and well-intentioned people who had an ideal view of humanity. They weren't realistic enough to realize how dangerous the psychopaths are. Now, there are many people that would argue that the psychopaths running the world, like, let's take Hillary Clinton. She's an easy shot, okay?
Okay.
Now, what are you going to do with Hillary Clinton? Are you going to love her? Well, go right ahead, and let's see where it gets you. One of the things that we've learned in the last 10 years or 12 years in this fast-track awakening since 9/11 is about psychopathy. How do you deal with psychopaths? You know, you cannot change a psychopath with love. Do you know that?
Oh, yes. Definitely.
Yes.
You've probably had interviews and people talking about this, right?
Yeah.
Well, we think this is a very important point for people to understand, because we're seeing in the light community or the spiritual communities that people have been holding on to the idea that love can be transformational. But I think even they are starting to notice now that the world is not really being transformed with the love that they have been holding these past years.
Well, that would be a great wake-up call for them, and I think it's a positive step.
Mm-hmm.
It's looking that way,
I hope so, too, and I would offer to those people, and I've known a great many of them in my life, hey, I lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Give me a break.
You were in the middle. Yeah.
I was in the middle of it. I would say this now to these people, and I say this with confidence and out of great compassion. Love can be a transformational force in the world in many ways, but what it cannot do is counteract the predators who do not want this experiment to succeed. It takes something more than love to face and defeat those people. Love cannot defeat those people.
That's right, and that is the truth. Love works on people who are loving, but it does not work on the predators, and it does not work on the psychopath. It does not.
That's right. It does not work on them.
No.
And so when I advise, and I simply advise that people consider this forbidden and tainted word, hate, I'm not suggesting that people become hateful and that we ourselves turn into hateful monsters like the psychopaths. I'm saying that there is a force in hate which is a defensive force.
It's self-protective, I think.
It's self-protecting, that you have to hate what harms life in order to protect life. It's not enough to forgive it. It's not enough to say, if we love it, it will change. You really have to hate that behavior. But there's an art and a skill and a challenge in doing that.
Right.
Can you hate that behavior and not be consumed by hatred?
Right.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the answer is, I'll give you this answer. Yeah, you can.
Yeah.
How do I know? Because that's what I do.
Right.
Yeah.
And I know that I can do it, and I know that other people can do it as well.
Oh, yeah.
John, you used another word once before, and I really loved it, and you said ruthless.
That's right.
And I think that it requires that, too.
Yep.
We have to be ruthless with the predators. They're not going to change. They only know how to lie. And the other thing that is really important to know about psychopaths, and this is now becoming common knowledge, you know, it's a wonderful thing that since 9/11, I don't think this existed before 2001, but since then, any intelligent person can go on the internet and spend, I would say, 10 hours. Just go and spend 10 hours in YouTube clips educating yourself about psychopaths. It's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's fantastic what we now know, because we had to learn this to survive. Because 9/11 taught us that the psychopaths have taken over this world to the extent that they run the social institutions and the governments.
Yeah.
And we have to know how they operate.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of them, too.
There's a lot of them, too. So to get back to the positive point, one of the things that I have learned and many others have learned about psychopaths is that they are unable to discern the consequences of their own actions, even the consequences to themselves. And so what are you going to do? Suppose you're on a bus and someone takes over, you know, knocks out the driver of the bus and takes over the bus and starts to steer it off the road.
You send them love and light.
Yeah, you send them love and light, right? As you're going over the cliff,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, the first thing you have to realize is that crazy person who has taken over the bus has no idea of the consequences of their own action, nor can they stop themselves. Hillary Clinton cannot stop herself. No psychopath can stop themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're control freaks. And control freaks cannot stop themselves. So we are faced with the question of what human resources we can find in ourselves to face and defeat these psychopaths. And we are exactly at the key moment of turning the tide in that battle. And that key moment corresponds in many ways with the timing of Sophia's correction.
Mm-hmm.
In many, many ways.
Yep. Totally agree. And so what does that turning of the tide look like, John? I mean, does it...
It looks like a real pushback.
Okay.
I love this term, pushback. Have you noticed how the term pushback has just come into... Yeah, in what? A month or two?
Yeah, it's being used more and more.
It's being used more and more, and this is what we want to see. We want to see pushback.
Mm-hmm.
Pushback is the proof that those human beings who believe in... that this experiment is a divine experiment and that we are the children of the goddess, no matter how they frame that in the language of their own minds, this is what they believe and know and feel. We are the magical children of this beautiful earth goddess who is truly our cosmic mother, who truly wants us to play and thrive and succeed together. And those who realize that there are some human animals who are sick, they're like rabid dogs. They're infected. The
mm-hmm.
Zionist master race theory is an infection.
Mm-hmm.
The control freak behavior of the psychopaths is an infection. And those demented, infected human animals will not just let us go on and fulfill the beautiful dream of this experiment. They don't want to see it fulfilled.
That's right.
They really don't. You have to know your enemy as well as you know your friends, as the Godfather once said. Good advice, you know?
Yeah.
And so the time has come to push back, and we are getting pushback in every area. They're starting to push back against Monsanto. This is massive.
Yeah.
There's starting to push back, as I say, this geopolitical drama that was enacted last month in the Middle East is a pushback against the Zionist Israeli gangsters. There's a pushback against the Fed. There's a pushback against the IRS. There's a pushback against Homeland Security. And the problem is, and I think this may change, I have a feeling that this may change in the next 6 months, because the predator class, who doesn't want this experiment to succeed, controls the mainstream news, we probably don't hear much about the pushback. there's probably a lot more happening than we actually hear about. Wouldn't you agree?
I agree. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah. Because naturally, if they control the narrative through the mainstream media, they are going to keep out of the narrative any stories that would indicate that they're losing control of the narrative.
Right. Yeah, that's
but they
true.
Are.
Yeah.
They are losing control of the narrative, you know. And more people are breaking the taboo, like I broke it this evening.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not totally comfortable with doing that. And I don't like to monopolize the conversation by that. But by that portal, we must pass. We must pass through that door where we can call it like it is.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, since we're on that particular taboo.
Yeah, taboo.
Let's talk about the other radical, religions, shall we say, whatever. It is what it is. How does the Islamic religion fit with the Gnostic, teachings? If there is anything, because it's a little...
It fits very well.
Yeah, there's some radicalized portions of it, so can you address that?
Sure. If you accept the metaphor of the virus, the ideological virus that the Gnostics introduced in discussing Judaism and Christianity, then you can describe the development of that virus in this way. The virus comes from an off-planet mentality, the Archons. And if you want to know about them, go and read about them on metahistory.org, because I've written a great deal about the Archons. In fact, I'm the person, as you know, who introduced the word Archon into the current discourse. People don't always use it in relation to the Gnostic story. They should, unfortunately, because it's a powerful concept. But the fact is it's being talked about, and that's a good thing. The Archons introduced, operating as mind parasites, they introduce this alien virus into the human mind, and they slip it into the minds of a very small tribal group of people at the beginning. The consequence is that this small tribal group begin to incubate a master race theory. The master race theory is the single most dangerous idea that can destroy this experiment. So already, the threat to the experiment begins with the chosen people concept of the Jews. But at first, it just incubates within that closed group, as I explained previously. It's like as if on the island of Manhattan, some people in an apartment building contracted Ebola virus.
Mm-hmm.
But at first, it just stayed among the people in that apartment building.
That's
the Jewish religion.
Until one of them went out on the subway and contaminated
them. One of them went out on the subway, or one of them decided, like St. Paul decided, to take the Jewish virus and convert it into a more user-friendly form for the world at large.
Right.
That's Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So Christianity is the first pandemic eruption of the Zadokite virus. It's the Zadokite cult of the Jews. It's not even all the Jews. It's just even a sliver cult among the Judaic religion, Zadokite. You can read about that in my book.
Mm-hmm.
So it explodes pandemically into Christianity, the virus, and then it explodes again into Islam. So from the point of view of the Gnostics, Islam is the second mutation of this virus. Christianity being the first.
Wow.
It's the second, and it's even more dangerous than Christianity.
Hmm.
Because in the way that the virus operates in Christianity, the virus inhabits the host, and the host serves the virus. Okay? But in the way it operates in Islam, get this, people are going to love this, people are going to hate me for this, it kills the host.
Oh. Yeah, true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It kills the host.
Wow.
And Islam is, I'm sorry to say, a very, very unfortunate belief system for humanity.
I mean,
because it's the final expression of this virus.
Yeah. It's definitely an infestation. There's something definitely. It's something.
And there's something inhuman and locust-like about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
About
yeah.
the behavior of Muslims. There's something inhuman and locust-like. It is a hive mentality. Now, the archons have a hive mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say, what a Gnostic would say to you today is, if you'd like to see a form of human society that has been morphed away from the true potential of this experiment toward what the archons would like to do to the experiment, then you look at Muslim society,
mm-hmm.
the conformity of it, the sexual apartheid, which is hideous beyond belief, the treatment of women. And I don't care what you say, you can have all the women in the world who converted to Islam come and tell me that Islam is good for women, and I'm never going to believe it.
That's
because
right.
it's just not true.
Thank you. Yeah. Just last week, there was a little 8-year-old girl who was married to a man.
That's right.
I mean, they're legal pedophiles. And the woman, I mean, the little girl, the 8-year-old girl, died that night during his sexual activities
with
her. That's
right. Well, I'll point out something to you.
Sickening.
Right. If you go and research on the internet into the Babylonian Talmud and Talmudic Judaism, which was a very virulent formulation of the anti-goy, anti-human stance of the Jews, okay? If you go and look at the rules and precepts of Talmudic Judaism, you'll find that they are identical with that of Islam. Talmudic Judaism gives the right to marriage to very young girls and the right to violate, you know, children, basically. That is a right mandated in Talmudic Judaism to the followers of that path,
mm-hmm.
you know. So Islam and Judaism are two sides of the same coin. And this whole game of this war between Judaism and Islam is really a very phony and deceiving game.
It's alien. It's just all alien crap.
It's all alien crap that goes back to the archons and goes back to the infection of the human mind by this archontic virus, which I call salvationist religion. Salvationist religion has destroyed this experiment, but Sophia's correction is the opportunity to throw off that crap, that evil virus, that deception, and to return to the way of life on this planet that is compatible with true human potential. In order to do that, we need to directly confront these taboos. And so what I'd like to do in the remaining, what we have about 10 minutes left of this interview?
Yes.
What I would like to do, if you don't mind, is to focus, and I think this is a really good focusing device, is to focus on what are the main taboos that need to be broken for the humanity to enter into this correction. You know, if you're not comfortable with the idea of Sophia's correction because you feel, well, we really don't know what he's talking about and we don't know enough about the myth, then let me give you a paraphrase for it. It means the healing of the human condition and the return to our divine potential.
Okay.
That's all it means. So if you can get on board with that, you're on board with Sophia's correction. Okay?
Right. We're on board.
Okay. In order to enact it, in order to bring it to success, we need to face four taboos. The first taboo is against saying anything against the Jews and against implying that there is somehow something about the Jews that is wrong. There is something about the Jews that is very, very wrong, and it's even wrong for the Jews. And we have to face that taboo of anti-Semitism and not be afraid to be accused of anti-Semitism, because what is the accusation of anti-Semitism? I'll tell you exactly what it is. This is the only thing that you need to know. It is a cover to protect the anti-humanism of certain people.
Interesting. Okay.
It's a ruse. It's a ploy. Because the people who cry anti-Semitism are actually carrying out an anti-human agenda. They are against humanity. And I have to tell you this as well, and this is the last word I'm going to say about the Jews. It's not me that is declaring that the Jews are the enemy of humanity. They have declared it themselves.
Yeah, This is understood. Yeah.
I hope so, because I know that there are some people who don't understand this yet. You know, here's John Lash saying, who are the enemies of humanity? I'm not saying that the Talmudic Jews and the Zadokite Jews, who are this very radical, virulent, infected group, are the enemies of humanity. They're saying it themselves. So pay attention to what they say. We break through that taboo. The other next taboo is about sex. We could have a whole interview about sex. We don't know nothing about sex. Nothing. It's really unfortunate. We have been so misinformed and so misled about sex. I mean, how many people in this world know who Wilhelm Reich is and what he said in his book, The Function of the Orgasm?
Well, some of us do.
Some of us do, but not very many.
Right.
Wilhelm Reich and his work represent the breakthrough on the taboo against sexuality. You see, sexuality is covered with a taboo. It goes back a very, very long way to the overthrow of the goddess cults by patriarchy. You know that story, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yes, right.
And I hope patriarchy is one of those taboos that need to go, the discussion against patriarchy. That needs to be addressed as well.
That needs to be addressed as well. And one of the tools and ploys that patriarchy uses to maintain its power and its corrupt position is that it, through religion, through the things that we are taught by in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam about sex are all wrong. So we're given a wrong sexual education in order to keep us down sexually. Because in Sophia's correction and in the divine, in the flowering and fulfillment of our divine birthright, sexuality is to be celebrated. Sexual energy and the beauty of the sexual behavior of the human animal is central to Sophia's correction. I call it the healing of the gender rift, the end of the war of the sexes, the return to the polaric, synergetic harmony of the male and female genders and variations of those genders. That is something that is part of her correction. But we can't get there if we stay in patriarchal morality about sex.
Right.
Patriarchal morality about sex leads to what happened to this little Muslim girl.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The next big taboo to face and confront is the taboo against the use of sacred plants to alter consciousness. That's a really big taboo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'll tell you something that might sound rather strange. People recently have come to realize that there's a war on food in this world, and that the governments in various countries, through the Codex Alimentarius and so forth, are trying to take control of what we can eat and tell us what we can eat. Well, so they're trying to force GMO foods down our throat and all that kind of thing, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, this is really an important battle. We all stand on the front lines of this battle. Because if someone is trying to control what you eat, they're going to be controlling your ability to live. So the point that I want to make is that that battle for the right to eat healthy food and the right to eat the way we want is the front line, but behind that there is an even deeper battle. And that is the battle over the question of the use of sacred plants and entheogens to change consciousness. And that is a taboo subject. It's very taboo.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so that taboo has to be broken. And I'm focusing on that right now. I'll take that one. Here, choose your taboo. We're handing them out here. Which one do you want to tackle? Don't leave this room unless you've got one of them.
All right, well, let's hear the last one and see which one I'll pick.
Well, the last one goes back to Iran, and I'm going to tell you a really interesting thing. I'm going to share with you something that I heard. You know how you hear rumors on the Internet?
Yeah.
And you don't know. You can, if you know how to use it and research it, you have to be highly selective. You can really learn fast on the Internet, can't you? It's a fast-track learning tool. But sometimes you just hear things on the Internet that's like, you can't actually confirm it, but you know it's really important, right? I heard something like that. I heard in the course of the summer, and I can't remember where because I can't find the link, that the real problem with Iran is not what the Zionist Israelis would have us think it is. Don't forget that the motto of the Zionist Israelis, which is the motto of the Mossad, is, by deceit we shall conquer.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's also comes
no
out of Talmudic.
There. Yeah.
That also comes out of Talmudic Judaism. Talmudic Jews state in their credo of ethics, if you want to laughingly call it that, that those who follow the Talmud and are faithful to their God, who is a demented alien, can lie and cheat to the rest of the world and there are no consequences. They are obliged to lie and cheat to the Goyim. This is in the Talmudic creed. And so you find it in the motto of the Mossad, by deceit we shall conquer. The Israelis are making this big issue. Oh, you know, Iran's going to attack us. They're very dangerous. They're producing nuclear weapons. And so you have this whole nuclear weapon scenario around Iran, right? That's just a smokescreen. What I heard in this Internet rumor, the real danger of Iran is that they have free energy.
Yeah, I did hear that.
Did you hear that?
I did.
Did that make your ears perk up?
Yes, it did.
Wow.
It made my ears perk up in a most wonderful way, because it somehow it really makes sense. And I wonder now that the geopolitical chessboard has changed, you know, I wonder now if Iran will start to reveal this. Because can you imagine what a transformation of the world that would produce if they did? If one country in this world, a country, came out and said, we have free energy and we're ready to share it.
And a country that has been riddled with violence for
oh, yeah.
its entire history,
mm-hmm.
it would be ironic.
It would be.
Yep.
Yep.
But you know, Iran has never attacked anyone in over 700 years.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Iran itself is not an aggressive country.
Right.
Yeah. And so free energy is the other taboo.
Mm-hmm.
Free energy, I am beginning to think, and I discussed this with the crew, and this will be my closing comment. With the G&E crew, Gaia Navigation Experiment, I'm saying that I wonder if it's possible within the next 3 months that we will have the great free energy breakthrough on this planet. And I'm even wondering if it might come from Iran. That would be really wild.
That would be. That would be. Well, John, thank you so much. What an amazing interview today. I mean, you've definitely shattered a whole bunch of taboos today. So thank you very much for that. I hope that we can continue with this conversation at a later date, because I know that there's a lot of things that we left kind of hanging that we still need to discuss a little bit further. But probably by the time that we discuss it again, we're going to probably be into more changes. So that should be...
Things are moving
on. Yeah, they're moving
on
very fast. So,
right.
Again, thank you very much for joining us and you know, giving us the honor of sharing this 2 hours with you. What is your website one more time?
It's metahistory.org, metahistory.org. And I want to thank you as well for this opportunity, and also for all listeners. I thank you for your patience, and I thank you for your tolerance and for hanging in there during this interview.
Yeah.
And I wish safe passage to everyone.
Absolutely.
Thank you. It's always great listening to you, John. We always learn a few more things each time, so thank you.
Absolutely. And you've all been listening to Shattering the Matrix. You can catch Serena and myself every Saturday night, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will catch you next week. Thank you very much for joining us. Good night, everyone. And, John, thank you very much. God bless.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.